And so here you go. Here's the certificate, you know, just like a used car. She's going to come with a title, free and clear. Here's the title. You see how
Moses, that's Moses's certificate of divorce.
having a certificate of divorce is a license to commit adultery.
And Jesus is speaking to that.
He is speaking to that. But you see what that does to the human soul when I make relationships contingent and all I have to do is check a box and go through a legal loophole.
Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast. We are seeking to recover faith by recovering the faith. I'm Kent.
And I'm Nathan.
And we're in a series, The Voice of the Shepherd, and we're looking to understand what it means to live by the gospel, follow the gospel, the voice of the which is the voice of the shepherd. And I asked Nathan a question, and I said, here's a question I've got for us in all of this. And he said, let's talk about it. So it's going to be our episode today. So we're starting to get into some practical questions in this series. We've sort of laid the theoretical.
Promised.
It has promised. We've sort of laid some theoretical foundation, and now we're going to get practical. And I told him that I've got a question that keeps coming up as we talk about this law-free life, this law-free Christian life. Something occurs to me from time to time that what about that teaching of Jesus on divorce and remarriage? And this has been occurring to me, I guess, for some number of years off and on, as Nathan and I have talked about living free from law. Didn't Jesus sort of give us a law on divorce and remarriage? He taught, he responded to the questions that were asked of him about marriage and divorce and remarriage, and he issued some statements, his interpretation of Scripture and his application. And then it comes down to us a couple thousand years later as basically Christian law, church law, and churches, even sometimes like the Roman Catholic Church, will call it church law. And they'll say the Lord gave us this word, this command. And so we have these teachings from Jesus. Don't get divorced, except in the case of sexual immorality, and then we expand that to include a couple other things, and don't get remarried unless your spouse is dead, your ex is dead or remarried. And that is like a pretty conservative interpretation of Jesus that's out there. And some people will even take it more conservative and say, if you're divorced, don't ever get remarried. And that's church law. That's Jesus' command. So, you know, we may decide those are bad interpretations of Jesus' teaching. Or we may say those are, in fact, Jesus' teachings, or something along those lines is Jesus' teaching. But it's not law. Okay, well then explain how it's not law,
right,
is my question to you.
Yeah, good question. Oh, stumpers. I like them. And I've been thinking about this a little bit. And, you know, Jesus taught a lot of things in the Sermon on the Mount throughout the Gospels. And, you know, as we know, that there's this kind of Jesus tradition. And it seems to, and we've mentioned this before, that the Gospels were the product of the church. They were not the genesis of the church. You know, when people are like, well, I just want to get that back to basics, and I'm just going to read the red letters. And I'm like, not a good idea. I know that sounds crazy, but, to be fair, there really are no red letter texts in the sense that all of this had to come through somebody's pen and somebody's memory. While the Gospels are, I mean, two of the Gospels are named for people and authored, by people who may have never met Jesus or certainly were not in his inner circle. Two are named for people who were in his inner circle, but, you know, there are some questions scholarship-wise, especially with Matthew, as to whether this was actually written by the publican, you know, the guy himself. It doesn't sound like a first-hand account of somebody, but also it seems to share a source document with Luke. That seems relatively obvious, and somebody would say, well, you know, Luke copied Matthew or something. But, you know, textual criticism, I don't think there are very many, if any, serious New Testament scholars who think that Luke got his material from Matthew. A lot of people believe that Mark is probably the earliest gospel and maybe closest to a firsthand account through perhaps Peter. And yet it's very quick and brief. You know, it doesn't really drill down as much into Jesus' teachings. It has some. And yet it seems that there was a Jesus tradition, an oral tradition, because Paul cites it specifically with this issue of marriage. As he says, you know, I don't have a command from the Lord about divorce and remarriage, or, you know, about getting divorced. In some cases, you know, he says, for those who aren't married, you know, what should they do? I don't really have a direct command. He says, but if you are married, you should stay married, because the Lord commanded that you should stay married, right?
Yeah, in that passage in 1 Corinthians 7, right?
Mm-hmm.
In one place there, he says, I say, not the Lord, which means the other thing I said is what the Lord said.
Right.
So there's Paul doing what the Roman Catholic Church does.
Right.
They say, well, we have a command from the Lord. Mm-hmm. This is the law. The Lord gave us this command.
Right. So, you know, 1 Corinthians 7, I think, is very interesting and instructive when we get to the idea of Jesus' teaching on marriage and divorce. And you know, by the way, if we're going to see Jesus' instructions as binding command tantamount to the Sinai covenant, you know, he taught a lot of other things too, you know, like we'd all be going around with one eye or maybe no eyes.
Yeah, depending on your interpretation there, literal. He said, gouge out your eye.
Right, yeah. Is there anybody whose eye has not offended them, mm-hmm. you know, at least with two, with an XY chromosome?
Mm-hmm.
There's just, you know, so much in there that, and you know.
Sell all you have teaching, and give it to the poor.
Yeah. And that, you know, and so we say, oh, that wasn't specifically to all believers. That's just to this one guy. But, you know, in Luke it says, whoever of you does not renounce all he has cannot be my disciple.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's not hard to you know, to see that the application is to everybody, mm-hmm. right? And yet there's a lot of people who have all the, you know, so why do we pick particular ones to say, okay, that one definitely binding, this one not as much,
mm-hmm.
And this is why I say, and it, you know, when people are like, well, I just want to get back to the Gospels, I want to get back to the foundations, and that it, number one, that's a fallacious thing to say, because the Gospels are a product of the church. They were written to the church and part of church life. The earliest gospel was probably written, 25 to 30 years after Jesus' death and resurrection. So this isn't something that the church was born out of, this extensive story of the life of Jesus of Nazareth. Okay? That this story of Jesus' life is the product of the church life and not the other way around. I know that sounds strange, and you know, we can't limit it to that. There's obviously some sort of a reciprocal relationship, mm-hmm. in that if Jesus were not who he is, then none of this would have mattered,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, and they were, and it was part of their church life. Like, those stories about Jesus were shared among Christians, and it in that sense produced and sustained the church's life,
right?
And then they produced the documents,
right.
called the Gospels.
Right. So, yeah, obviously there was an oral tradition, a lot of disparate fragments about what Jesus taught. They were coming from the apostles and others. But as that apostolic era was coming to an end, and I think it's plausible to say that nobody thought about writing it down until these apostles were getting rather old or whatever, you know, and people are just like, I don't think Jesus is coming back in their lifetime, you know? I mean, I think that was their thinking, was there was going to be maybe this 25-year period of like a mass reformation of Israel, and then Jesus would return, right? Mm-hmm. Or however long. But something that would have been within the span of one person's life, a significant period of time in the span of one person's life, where history would come to a close, that clearly was not the plan. And as they began to realize that, then the Jesus tradition began to be written down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe it was in the wake of the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, 70 AD, and this movement has now launched and become no longer a Jewish sect, but now its own thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And so people are, we need these documents, some sort of foundation to cling to. So I guess that wasn't the purpose of this, but I do think it does say something, that my contention that the gospel ought to be at the root. You know, if we want to be radical, we have to get to the radum, right? The very core of this. And so the root has to be the gospel, in that's the portable message that traveled into the world and got people wondering, who's this Jesus guy anyway? Mm-hmm. You know, that the question of who is Jesus of Nazareth, what was his life like, all of that only came after people realized that this one had died for them and he'd risen again, and that history has now been changed, and now my personal history has changed. I've been born again. I've had this encounter with a spirit, as Paul talks about, the spirit of Christ. Mm-hmm. So there's some sort of a new era that we're in where we're connected to Jesus of Nazareth, and he's critically important. He's somebody that we love, that he's a contiguous being with the one in the Old Testament who's the angel of the Lord. He comes to earth. And I think that, you know, that there's a radical shift in who and what he is somehow, in becoming fully human, that you know, nothing's ever going to be the same again because of that. And he remains fully human. And so Jesus of Nazareth, who walked on this planet and did what he did and all this, is still the one in heaven. And there's a continuity there. And yet Paul speaks of a shift in the way we relate to him, you know, and I'm speaking particularly of in 2 Corinthians 5, where he talks about that we used to know Christ according to the flesh, but now we know him this way no more. Mm-hmm. So there's something about his dying on the cross that changes the interface, you know, the way that we relate to him. So, and the book of John, I think, stands on this watershed. If we look at the Gospel of John, which many believe is the latest written, you know, in the series, and I'll be frank, when I read John, I don't hear the voice of somebody who actually knew Jesus personally. You know, maybe he's a biographer for that person, mm-hmm. or something like that. But he seems to be writing there's so much actual pastoral edge to it, that he's really ministering to the church. Mm-hmm. More than writing a biography. Mm-hmm. And John's a problematic book for most people.
As a biography, it's problematic.
Yeah.
It doesn't fit the storyline of the other three.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It really places Jesus, you know, in this weird, doing these laps between Jerusalem and Capernaum. Nazareth isn't really mentioned like it is in the other ones. It's not even really, it doesn't seem to have the other ones as a referent much. Maybe that speaks of an independent tradition and somebody that actually knew him. You can make that argument. But all that to say is that one thing that John does, I think, is it stands very clearly in this place between Jesus teaching on earth as he's saying these things that are very cryptic and strange and off-putting. And the case seems to be made through the book of John that people are not able to accept his teaching. That there's something fundamentally broken about human society, that these kind of erudite sayings of Jesus that aren't particularly moral in their, you know, in their thrust, except for just love each other and stuff like that, but that they are related to who he is. You know, he says, I'm the bread of life, I'm the living water, you know, and he makes all these claims. I'm the good shepherd. And everybody's like, I have no clue what you're saying. But then he says, hey, after this event, you'll get it. Mm-hmm. So he really helps us, I think. I think the book of John helps us. And I think it's interesting that it sits as the last gospel. You know, it's almost like this portal between Jesus' earthly ministry, mm-hmm. and what was to come. Mm-hmm. For us. So, all that to say, we're definitely, when we read Jesus' teachings on earth, that we are definitely looking back through a lens into a different era.
Different era, right? That it's a former era, and the division, mm-hmm. between the former era and the present era is the resurrection of Christ.
Right. Right. Yeah. So,
and so we see him differently, we treat him differently, we follow him differently in this current era.
Right.
as contrasted with the previous era.
Right.
And that would, in your the implication there is that that includes even some things he commented on scripturally, possibly.
Sure. And I'm not saying we discount them or we disregard what he said. I think that we have to take them with the same kind of approach that we take when we talk about Paul's instructions. You know, we've been saying that this Paul's instructions to the church after the resurrection are largely an interpretation of that event, right? And so Christ's teaching is a prefiguring. You know, he's like, something's shifting. Okay, and if you think about the doctrine of divorce and remarriage particularly, I think that it illustrates the shift in approach from a legal approach to one of core righteousness, you know, this righteousness of faith. Okay, so Jesus is really, if you look at the context of Jesus' teaching most of the time, especially, and I'm thinking of Matthew and Mark. I can't remember if Luke has the teaching on divorce and remarriage, but I know that Matthew and Mark. So Matthew 19, Mark 10, where Jesus says, you know, if any of you divorces your wife except for fornication, which I think is interesting, he doesn't say adultery. And I'm like, what? You know, why does he
porneia?
Porneia, right. Mm-hmm. Except for fornication. I'm like, why does he use that term as opposed to adultery? You know, and does it go the other way? Because it doesn't, you know, I guess he does. He says if any woman divorces her husband, but he doesn't give that exception in the other direction, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of inferred.
Yeah, it is by us, but maybe not by them. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, I think that in the first century, marriage was a very different thing. Mm-hmm. It's not the same as what we have, and we'll talk about that. But at any rate, that Jesus is contrasting his coming kingdom with status quo for observant Jews in the first century. And I think we have to have that as a backdrop, you know, that what we tend to do, because we come out of this kind of litigious tradition, you know, in America, our ethic is legal code. You know, there are other, and we can't even imagine somebody who has an ethic that's not legal code. I recommend that people read, there's a book called Misreading Scripture Through Western Eyes. O'Brien and, but the Richardson, I think, is the primary author on that, Randolph Richardson and Brandon O'Brien. And, you know, they talk about, they provide some insight as people who, especially Richardson, who is I think that I'm saying his name right. I hope I am. Anyway, at any rate, he was a missionary to Indonesia, you know, and being in an honor shame culture, realizing that, you know, that the approach to even law there, you know, things are illegal unless they're not. You know, that just because something's written and prohibited under law doesn't mean that it's illegal all the time for everybody. They just, they're like, this, you know, it's more guidelines, you know. So the authors would contend that the first century culture was probably closer to that approach, although obviously Israel would have been maybe more legalistic, obviously. But the culture that they're writing into, at any rate, but when we see something like that, when we read Jesus and he says, anyone who divorces his wife causes her to commit adultery, you know, and he commits adultery against her, right? And he causes her to commit adultery. And Mark, it goes on and says, any woman who divorces her husband commits adultery, you know, marries another, commits adultery. And when we read that, what we infer is that the marriage relationship endures beyond divorce.
In God's eyes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So.
Like, God doesn't validate any divorce unless it's on the grounds of porneia.
Right. 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 That, yeah, he's got to certify the divorce, I guess, you know, that you get your legal papers, then you go to God and you're like, okay, I need you to stamp this and, you know. But I think we may be reading too much into it when we do that. Because, for one, there's, when Paul gives this exception in 1 Corinthians 10 that if you have an unbeliever who's your spouse and they want to leave, you're good to go. You know, that there, mm-hmm. that he demonstrates a difference there, that there's something binding about the command of the Lord in the case of two believers that's not binding in the case of a believer and an unbeliever. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, does that mean that Christian marriage has some sort of substance to it that a marriage between a believer and an unbeliever doesn't have? What about two unbelievers? What makes the marriage bond? Has God joined two unbelievers who get married and make a covenant?
Is it not a human? Is it not an institution given by God to all humans? This right. is what we say, right? We look right. back to Genesis,
right? Yeah, before Moses, right? Before Abraham, before Jesus, of course, that there's this one flesh union that seems to be fundamental to being human, to being two humans getting married, you know, two, I would go as far as to say opposite sex humans getting married, but, you know, we can talk about that later. At any rate, you know, it seems to be this endorsement of that the complementary difference between these two entities implies that they are united in some way when they get married. Mm-hmm. And that Jesus goes to that teaching in the tradition, you know, in the Jesus tradition. He says, look, that's marriage right there, right? And so whatever Moses wrote later in Deuteronomy about divorce, it doesn't supersede that. And yet, why would God allow a provision like that? You know?
And Jesus said God allowed that provision because of your hardness of heart.
Right.
Right, in the Gospels.
Yeah, right,
He's right. like, that's why you got divorced, is because you're hard-hearted. And so Moses gave you these rules and regulations.
Right.
To protect. And, you know, people will even point out, and it's really to protect the woman.
Right. It is.
Okay, so where are we at in this conversation?
Well, what I'm saying is that if we read Jesus to say that marriage endures after divorce, okay, and that from then on, that every time that the second couple, so let's say two people get divorced, right, and they go on and remarry other people, mm-hmm. okay, and then from that moment on, that
those are adulterous relationships.
Those adulterous, every time those people have intercourse, that they're committing adultery against the other person, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And maybe the people that they marry are divorced and remarried, you know? And right. now we've really got a mess.
Right. So this is the really theological interpretation of Jesus' statement that Christians have.
Right.
And you're saying we might be reading too much into Jesus' statement.
I think so, just because if that were the case, God would not have allowed a provision, I don't care how hard your heart is. Okay? Because obviously condoning adultery would not be, or allowing a provision for it, saying, well, as long as you have a piece of paper, it's still adultery. I mean, that's what Jesus is saying, right? Mm-hmm. That it's still adultery, but at least you have a license to commit adultery, mm-hmm. and so you can. Mm-hmm. What? That doesn't make sense. That doesn't add up. Okay. And then Paul says, look, if you're married to an unbeliever and they go, license to commit adultery, right? Wait.
Right. Yeah. So if we're reading too much into it, can you maybe say again what you think it might mean? Mm-hmm. In a more like what is this more simple, less problematic reading?
Sure. Well, the way I see it is that Jesus is dealing less with legal guilt and more with spiritual development in his teachings. Mm-hmm. And so when Paul says everything is lawful but not everything is helpful, mm-hmm. that when we read Jesus, what we're seeing is somebody who's peeling the legal veneer off the law. And he's saying, look, if you use the law to be a serial, you know, have a series of marriage relationships, you know, like if you're just basically wife swapping every time you can do that because you have a piece of paper, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. so, you know, you married this woman and maybe she was just 10 years your junior. Mm-hmm. Okay, but now you've been married to her for 10 years, and now you're looking at somebody else that's younger or something else, or maybe she hadn't had a son for you, and there's somebody else who's like, you know, I think your wife's very beautiful, and, you know, And he's like, well, yeah, I don't want to leave her out there with nothing. And so it's like, how about this? I'll give her the certificate and you can take her. And that way she's not without, maybe you take her as a second wife, mm-hmm. you know, and I mean, I want to make sure she's cared for, but I don't want to be with her anymore. And so here you go. Here's the certificate, you know, just like a used car. She's going to come with a title, mm-hmm. free and clear. Here's the title. You see how yeah.
Moses, having, that's Moses's certificate of divorce.
Right, having a certificate of divorce is a license to commit adultery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Jesus is speaking to that.
He is speaking to that. And but you see what that does to the human soul when I make relationships contingent and all I have to do is check a box and go through a legal loophole. You know that Muslims... and I don't know if this is in every case, but this is something I don't have some great source here. Okay, this is all something like 90 Day Fiance or something, where in some Muslim cultures that they have a thing called temporary marriage. You know, so you could be married for a night mm-hmm. if you want to just sleep around. You're technically married for a night, but mm-hmm. then you move on. Now, what does that sound like? You know,
right, right. Using the law to avoid legal guilt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you could be like, well. I think you're a slut. And you're like, well, of course not. You know, I just go through this temporary marriage, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. obviously I'm not, but someone from the outside is saying, no, you are, you know what I'm saying? And so Jesus he's peeling back this veneer and this legal cover. When he's indicting the Pharisees, he's saying, you need to be more righteous than they are. It doesn't mean that we're saying, okay, well, they gave 10%. I'm going to give 11%. Mm-hmm. He's talking about a shift in the way we view righteousness. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's how I see the marriage and divorce teaching, that Jesus is just taking away the cloak, as it were. And he does that with other things, mm-hmm. you know.
But doesn't Paul in 1 Corinthians 7 take up Jesus' teaching mm-hmm. and apply it? As though it's binding. Am I wrong?
Right. It is binding, but it's not binding in the sense of transgressive law, because he says, "I have this command from the Lord." Right. And yet he says, "But if you are married to an unbeliever, the command doesn't mm-hmm. apply." Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, Paul, who are you, and you know, what do you think mm-hmm. you're doing? But keep in mind that if the purpose of the command is to teach us that we ought to be faithful even when it's hard, right? Mm-hmm. But you have somebody who's not under Christ's authority, and I can't bring them under Christ's authority, and I can't hold them accountable. You know, Paul says, look, we can't hold the people of the world accountable to this righteousness.
Right.
In 1 Corinthians 5, just a couple of chapters earlier, he's like, you know, I told you not to keep company with people who are involved in gross immorality. I didn't mean the people of the world. You'd have to leave the world, right? He's like, that doesn't apply to them out there because they're not under his authority. Same way with marriage. How can, you know, it suggests that Paul understood Jesus' command as having some assumptions behind it. Mm-hmm. And one of those is that both people have willingly brought themselves under his authority and are taking his authority seriously, mm-hmm. you know. Now, it doesn't teach or doesn't presume that there is some sort of mystic bond between two people that endures after they get divorced. Paul doesn't seem to have understood Jesus to be teaching that, because he would not allow the dissolution of a marriage between a believer and an unbeliever. He would mm-hmm. say, look, if you were married to an unbeliever when you became a Christian, and you know, you were an unbeliever and they didn't come, and now, you know, you're just hosed and that's life, right? Mm-hmm. And if they leave you, that's too bad, you know?
Right.
That there seems to be some freedom to remarry when an unbeliever leaves you. And it's because you'd had no control over what they were going to do, that there's some sort of agreement to the Lord's authority, and that we can't enforce these commands on anybody who doesn't have faith. Mm-hmm. And so if that's the case, that person has to be free to go. And the believer, who has no control over what that person does, they haven't chosen divorce. They haven't in their heart committed adultery through mm-hmm. this divorce. Mm-hmm. You know? That they are now free, because it wasn't so much that they were trying to trade out their spouse. And I think that's what Jesus is addressing. Mm-hmm. You know, not so much that there's some mystical bond that continues. Mm-hmm. That seems to be much more cohesive with all the material about divorce and remarriage. And so, I don't think that Paul or anybody, and I'm not, would advocate discounting or disregarding Jesus' teaching on anything. Mm-hmm. Right? That we need to wrestle with it. We need to accept it. But it's not a part of a legal code where there's an infraction, and once you've broken it, you carry this guilt and all this.
Which is actually how the, like, sort of more fundamentalist church has practiced this law, right?
Right.
This is not so much the case anymore. The church is changing and evolving in this, mm-hmm. In this, as on other things.
Right.
But it used to be that you were really persona non grata if you were divorced.
Right.
And you had certainly better not get remarried.
Right. Right. And I do think we need to take Jesus seriously. If you're in a marriage and say you're not happy and your mind begins to wander and you think, I would have been happier if I would have married that person. Man, that's adultery. Stop. Mm-hmm. any fool will tell you that.
Yeah.
Okay. That if your heart and your mind and, begins to entertain the notion of another person, you're committing an adulterous infraction against your spouse. I shouldn't have to say that. Nobody should have to say that to anybody. If we have this fundamental sense, if the gospel has really changed us, and I'm not going out there pursuing my own personal satisfaction through a relationship. And I really kind of want to drop a peg here and say that I think that the gospel implicitly, if we didn't have the material about Jesus, which a lot of Christians did not have until the writing of the gospels, okay, that there was a Jesus tradition, but I think it's easy to assume that the Thessalonian church for however long did not have that teaching. Mm-hmm. Okay, Paul's only there 3 weeks before he's run out of town. The Galatian church probably for a long time did not have that teaching because mm-hmm. Paul's run out of town after 2 weeks, right? Mm-hmm. What they had was the gospel. Mm-hmm. But with the gospel on board, I would say that it's clear, if we look at the gospel, it seems clear that having being unfaithful in our hearts towards somebody, anybody, mm-hmm. if we have an agreement with them and we say, look, I've made a commitment to you, that unfaithfulness in whatever it is, it's just beyond the pale. It shouldn't occur. If I've died to this and I am a person who's living in faith, I'm living in the assumption of a coming reality where legal prescriptives are irrelevant because of with inner righteousness. Mm-hmm. There's never been, well, I wouldn't say never, there's never been a civilized culture where betrayal has been a virtue, mm-hmm. And it's because we just can't keep society going like that, that it's kind of an implicit thing that to betray a person is inherently wrong. People do it for personal gain, but if you have accepted the riches of God through Christ, what need do you have for personal gain?
Yeah, what you're saying now is what our series argues.
Right.
The Voice of the Shepherd argues is that there's an ethic built into the gospel.
Right, right. People go out into the world that the things like adultery and divorce and remarriage happen oftentimes because of this insatiable personal need within the soul of the individuals. Mm-hmm. And so if a person, like if you and I are kind of just pushing each other to look at Christ and to be filled up with Christ, right, to accept, to take on the mantle of Christ in this world, okay, and that is implicit in our gospel, that the idea of betraying the person closest to us, that what we've made an agreement with and maybe we have children in common with and everything, and to dissolve that somehow, right, it's just not allowed. It shouldn't occur, okay? It doesn't mean people aren't tempted, they don't have weak moments, but that ought to tell them, hey, something's wrong. Mm-hmm. It's a diagnostic tool. And really, again, we're trading a legal metaphor for one that's closer to a hygiene or health metaphor. Mm-hmm. And so if I begin to have those kinds of thoughts, those longings, I should know immediately something's wrong with me, I'm I've been walked down a path and I'm in the process of being hardened and deceived. And that should terrify me. Mm-hmm. I should run back to the church and say, hey, something's bad wrong, you know, and I need you to pray for me and I need to be healed, which is what James counsels us to do in James 5, right? Mm-hmm. Confess your sins, pray for one another, that you might be healed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's really a health metaphor. Now, let's say somebody, you have two Christians and they've gotten divorced, right? I think number one, that if that happens in our community, it says that, you know, we as a community have been unhealthy. We have not, you know, superintended the souls. We've not gospeled each other very well. Mm-hmm. I mean, we ought to be.
Yeah, they're not the only people who have failed. There's a system that's failed.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, right. Because we ought to be so in pursuit of Christ that this notion of my own dissatisfaction and my craving for somebody else's affections ought to be recognized as some sort of pathology and not as a call to a happier life, mm-hmm. which is where people begin to go. It's how this is the genesis of this failure. You know, if there's a no-fault marriage, if there's no-fault divorce where neither person has cheated on the other, we just have irreconcilable differences and we're miserable and we can't do this anymore, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, now I know that happens, right? But even in that case, the purpose of your life is not to be happy necessarily, one. Mm-hmm. Two, one or both of those people need to repent. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if I'm just making my wife's life a living hell, there's something bad wrong with me, mm-hmm. you know, and somebody needs to call me on the carpet, mm-hmm. you know. So within the Christian community, we ought to be able to resolve this and at least get people to a place of just amicable indifference, at least, mm-hmm. you know, for the sake of the kids, for the sake of the reputation of the gospel, mm-hmm. For the sake of their own commitments that they made. You know, people ought to be able to at least get to there, mm-hmm. you know. So that and the fact that, again, I'm not here. The gospel has set me free from this pursuit of my own personal fulfillment or happiness outside of Christ, you know, or to supplement Christ with that. Mm-hmm. So all of that ought to safeguard marriage. And all of it ought to speak to the fact that if a divorce and remarriage takes place, that there's something. I know of an older couple that you know, they did exactly this, and they're very religious people. But it was like there were a couple friends, right? And you know, husband A decided he was in love with wife B, you know, and so husband A divorces wife A and marries wife B, and you know, and it's like, and these people just keep on going, you know, just keep going to church and doing their thing, and you know, I don't know, you know, there's something, the fact that that would ever occur, and that, I mean, that if you knew that was going on in the church, would you need a specific command that says that's bad? Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like you should. If the underlying ethic is to love people unselfishly, mm-hmm. that, you know, I just can't imagine the suffering that was caused by that decision, not just for husband B and wife A, but also their kids. You know, how confusing that would be, you know, just the rift, their extended family, the friends that were around them, the community that's around them. Just think about how poisonous that action was, you know, and the capacity that we have to justify our actions, to think this is probably what God wants me to do, you know, it's very messed up. But anyway, yeah, I think we should take everything Jesus said very seriously. And yet at the same time, if somebody does that, let's say that a divorce and remarriage has happened. Mm-hmm. Okay. What are the implications now, okay, for the community, for the parties involved? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think in our conversations, where we're headed is we're not treating these people as lawbreakers, mm-hmm. because we're not under law. There's not some law of marriage and divorce and remarriage, mm-hmm. and therefore these people are lawbreakers. But we're and so they are not put into a different category,
right?
But rather, we're all just seeking to grow together, mm-hmm. in the Lord, and we just minister to them. And if there's issues in their life that brought about that divorce and that remarriage, let's work on the underlying issues, mm-hmm. and not focus on any on a law that was broken.
Right. Yeah. And I think that for the individuals and the community to move forward, I do think that there has to be some confession of sin, that they should not have done this. Mm-hmm. You know, but now they're married, and that is a second marriage, and it's just as much a marriage as the first one, mm-hmm. was. And so now, you know, let's say that, you know, we have people come in and they're divorced and remarried. They've been married 6 or 7 years, and maybe they've got a kid, and, you know, both of them have an ex-spouse out there, and that ex-spouse has moved on and gotten married as well.
Yeah, that's very normal nowadays.
Right.
Yeah, that's the situation now.
Yeah. And let's say that these people are, maybe they were Christians when all this happened, but now they really wanted to get serious about their faith. Maybe they were nominal. They weren't part of a church community, or maybe they were part of an unhealthy one, and now they're really wanting to get serious about their faith. And we say, hey, if you really want to follow Jesus, you need to get divorced, go back to your previous spouses, convince them to get divorced, remarry them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a domino rally, and it's a disaster, right? And yet, if we're really going to be consistent with this idea that there's a mystical union that endures beyond a legal divorce, we have to do that. We have to counsel them that way, mm-hmm. you know.
Or maybe a more pressing, maybe more realistic case would be that two people who are Christians get divorced, they go on with their lives, neither is yet remarried. Mm-hmm. One of them comes to our church and then starts to date someone and wants to marry this someone. Mm-hmm. This more conservative interpretation of Jesus's teachings would mean, if we're under those teachings as binding, we're supposed to counsel them, wait, you can't remarry, mm-hmm. except you can remarry your original spouse. You should, sure. be reconciled to them.
Sure, yeah.
And that's the, yeah. law, and that's, yeah. what you have to do. Mm-hmm. You have this. You only have this one option.
Right. Right, yeah, and maybe
that's good advice.
You know, if it happened 30 days ago,
yeah,
or
maybe,
something,
yeah, it's
the
recent.
Other person wants to reconcile, and then, yeah, I mean, I think that they should at least entertain that notion, and maybe they should entertain the notion of just being single for a while. You know, the gospel is a call to a transcendent kind of a righteousness, not just
law-keeping.
Not just law-keeping, which is very minimalistic in terms of righteousness. You know, in terms of the, you know, the gospel should be asking, what's the best thing I can do right now? Not, what am I allowed to do? And so if somebody is serious about following Jesus and they've been through a divorce as a believer, and it was something that they just, you know, they just couldn't tolerate that person, they kicked them to the curb or whatever, and you know, maybe they should stop. They should think, you know, they should think, you know, how convenient is it that I can now marry this person, you know, how easily we rationalize the things we want to do and baptize them because we found some kind of a loophole or an out, you know. The fact that this may not be some, you know, infraction of a law doesn't really give it the weight of permission or endorsement either.
Right.
You know, but that the pursuit should be for righteousness, the kingdom of God, the, you know, the reputation of God and his people and the world. And that this, if these things are driving this person, then that's a good thing to do. Right. Mm-hmm. And it may be that, you know, he needs to marry the second person, that's something that God would endorse. But I wouldn't presume it. And I wouldn't presume that this person needs to be married to be fulfilled. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and that's the thing that Paul is dealing with in 1 Corinthians 7, is this idea that in Christ, there's no longer this assumption that if you're not married, you're incomplete. You know, that's been done away. And I think that there's a freedom there, that Jesus is giving a freedom. He's not laying on some sort of a obligation, but that if singleness is something that's legitimate and maybe even to be encouraged in some cases, that brings about a liberation for everybody. And that the church, in some ways, you know, if you think about in the first century, as Paul counsels, as kind of almost like plan A for most people in 1 Corinthians 7 is to remain single, which, you know, is a massive departure from, say, you know, Jewish tradition. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's a massive financial burden on the family if you follow through with that teaching, right? Let's say you have several daughters and they decide they want to be devoted to the Lord and they don't want to get married, but they're betrothed to a believing man, right? Okay, so where do they live? You know, in whose house do they live? Because betrothal was just as binding as marriage. So this guy's not free to go off and marry somebody else. He's committed to her. This becomes problematic, financially problematic. Is the man supposed to, the betrothed supposed to support the woman? You know, is the father supposed to support the woman ad infinitum? What if the father's, you know, 35, 40 years older than his daughters because he married later in life and had a younger wife and all that? And he's the sole source of support for now his wife and his three daughters. Mm-hmm. You know, what happens when he dies? Are these people now in total destitution because they don't have a husband? That there's so much financially in all of this that we don't fully appreciate. So when Paul counsels people to remain single, he's asking a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, not just in terms of my social, psychological, emotional, sexual fulfillment, but in terms of financial fulfillment, you know, that he's saying to the betrothed man, you can decide to live a life of singleness, but you still have to support this woman. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like, what? You know, that, and in marriage and things like that, we think of what we're entitled to and stuff. We still measure marriage against maybe a pre-Christian standard. Mm-hmm. Right? Rather than seeing all of this as really being about Jesus. So if I'm married, I should be married for Jesus. And that changes things. Mm-hmm. It doesn't, you know, I'm no longer married for all of the reasons people get married. You know, that there's this some sort of a contractual agreement when we get married, right? And we feel we're owed a certain set of things in exchange for a certain set of things. And yet Paul is very much reshaping that in 1 Corinthians 7. He's like, you're not owed anything. And if you do nothing but give and receive nothing back, well, the Lord's got you. You know? And you're receiving wealth that you wouldn't have otherwise. And so, you know, praise God. So, you know, he's saying, look, the one who keeps his virgin, right? I mean, that's what he's saying, right? He's maintaining her lifestyle. While he's not reaping any of the benefits, he's not having children, he's not having sexual relations, he's just maintaining her lifestyle. Okay? You know, he's saying the one who marries his virgin does well, and the one who keeps her does better. Mm-hmm. It's like, what? I mean, that's a massive shift in the way we see things. But again, if we could allow the gospel to shape our view of relationships, that we are giving to a person, and that, yeah, we're allowed a certain set of things, and that's fine, but we're not owed a certain set of things. And that, you know, so our approach to the other person shifts. And I think that takes us to the far end of the spectrum away from somebody who would divorce and remarry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. You know? Yeah, this higher righteousness, and Jesus spoke about the higher righteousness. That's the meaning of the Sermon on the Mount, right? Mm-hmm. You're supposed to have this righteousness that goes far beyond the legal righteousness right. of the scribes and Pharisees. This is true righteousness that comes from within.
Right.
So when we have that operating in our lives, ruling our lives, then, you know, the law, any law against divorce and remarriage is basically irrelevant to us,
right?
Because we're going to do right by our spouse.
Right. And we're going to give to them unconditionally, support them, you know, fulfill their needs. And I'm not saying that our needs are irrelevant, right? But I'm saying that they're not a deal breaker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that because Christ will ultimately meet my needs. And if I were single, he would meet my needs just as well. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm free in that way. I'm free to love. And I think that the person who cheats on their spouse or divorces their spouse in order to remarry or just divorces their spouse in hopes of eventually remarrying, that person is entirely trying to settle the score. In their mind, they're thinking, I want an equitable relationship. That's mm-hmm. what they're thinking in their mind. And to your point, Jesus says, if you don't invite over the people who can invite you back. You know, don't loan to people who can give to back to you, or don't give to those who can reciprocate. He's like, you know, you have to get over this notion that your relationships have to be fair. If you can't, they'll never be righteous, because we're always biased. If we're always trying to find something fair, something equitable, and we're like, this person doesn't appreciate me, and this marriage isn't equitable, and I need to find somebody who will appreciate me because this person's the problem. You see how that thinking's broken at the very beginning? Mm-hmm. It goes beyond marriage. It really is someone is divorced from Jesus before they're divorced from their spouse. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I think the healthy church can help somebody realize, you know, hey, you need to be deeply connected to Christ, and he needs to be your mainstay and your, you know, your fulfillment. And out of that fulfillment, you are equipped now to give and to love as he does. Mm-hmm. And also equipped to tell the other person when they've hurt you, and to communicate your needs to them, because you are pursuing a mutual relationship, just as Christ does with his church. You know, mm-hmm. Christ isn't a cosmic enabler. He wants his wife. Mm-hmm. You know, he's wooing his wife. He will rebuke his wife, right? All of that's important, but he's not going to divorce his wife, because then that makes her a disposable human being, and mm-hmm. it depersonalizes her. And so I think that's the same.
The righteousness of Christ that the gospel produces, the true righteousness of God that the gospel produces, will actually produce lives which actually fulfill these commands Jesus gave about divorce and remarriage. Mm-hmm. It's just that we won't be fulfilling those commands by aiming at fulfilling those commands. Instead, mm-hmm. we will be aiming at loving
right.
one another as Christ loves us.
Right. If I can borrow from a pagan tradition, you know, Plato had this cave analogy, right, where there's a higher reality that the physical realm is a shadow of. Okay. And that a philosopher is somebody who can recognize the forms behind the shadow. Okay. And that the forms behind the shadow, the ideals, are a reflection of a higher realm of truth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, in the Christian conception, that higher realm of truth is spiritual reality, heaven. Okay. I would say that Jesus' teaching is analogous to the philosophical forms. Somebody giving this description of reality as it really is, and casting that into a land of shadows. So, you know, when Jesus says, Jesus isn't saying, thou shalt not divorce thy wife. He says, anyone who divorces his wife does this.
Mm-hmm.
He's not mm-hmm. giving a instruction. He's pulling a veil back on the way things are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his instructions are that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so Jesus says, if you are, you know, if you're my disciple and you stick around, right, then you'll know the truth. That the gospel, I think, is the expression of the truth, is that, you know, it's this blinding light of truth. and that Jesus' teachings are the little, you know, the forms, the descriptions of reality. But just like the guy in the cave, we can't perceive the forms. All we can see are the shadows. And I think that, so Jesus' teachings are the forms, but the gospel is the light. You know, the gospel is the actual truth behind the truth. And all of these things are just subordinate truths, small t, that come out of the gospel. Mm-hmm. So Jesus' teaching is less about providing a legal framework.
A standard for life.
Right. And more about describing how things are, what things are. Mm-hmm. Because I think that, you know, as he says, if you know the truth will set you free.
Good note to end on. There we go. Thank you, Nathan. Good talk. Folks, if you got questions about this, you can always email us to discussion@recoverfaith.org. Thank you. We'll see you next time.